For as long as I've known the NBA, it's been a stars league. But even among the stars, there's an exclusive club. Russell, Dr. J, Jordan, Kobe. They're all part of a select group that paved the way for the NBA superstar of today. And some even shared secrets with each other along the way. From Spotify and the Ringer Podcast Network, I'm Jackie McMullen, and this is the Icons Club.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a three-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
Oh, hold up. Smell test. Go ahead. Sniff those pits. Now, your bits. Feet, toes, come on. Ugh. Could be fresher, right? It's all good. Old Spice Total Body Deodorant Spray is gentle enough to use all over your body, giving you 24/7 lasting freshness with daily use, from pits to toes and down below. So every smell test gets a... Shop for Old Spice Total Body Deodorant.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com. And joining me on the other line, my favorite London museum clerk, it's Andy Greenwald!
All right, I'm a bit of a superhero, ain't I?
Oh, yeah.
Hello?
I was waiting for right. The chim-chiminy coming through pip, with the pip. Moon Knight voice. Welcome to the podcast, everybody. Andy and I are here to talk a lot about, we got a lot of television. Andy just pulled a classic, gets up 5 seconds into the podcast to go turn a bunch of stuff off that he left on. We're humming, though. We have a lot of shows to burn through. Andy, it's great to see your face. I'm still in Philadelphia.
I like the idea. What people don't know is I just have a lot of like little individual Bunsen burners and like Sterno things on. I've got a lot of chafing dishes warming. And sometimes I forget, you know, I'm so committed to this podcast, Chris. We have so much TV to talk about.
People
I can't
think that
be
we've lost our spark after 10 years. Mm-hmm. There's some speculation. No. But let me tell you something. It's rare that you find two guys who can make it work while either one is turning off several appliances throughout a podcast or the other starts reading Pro Football Talk while you talk.
Are you finally admitting it?
I don't do it all often. But when I can tell you're going to go for a while, I'm just like, let me see the waiver wire, you know?
What's incredible is that we've been doing this for so long that when I see your eyes go dead... I assume you're just like, this is an opportunity for me to hone my craft and really like check the Nielsen numbers on the show I'm about to cite once the conch gets passed back to me.
I'm seeing if Nick Sirianni had a press conference today.
Listen, that's fine. You're my first listener. As long as the rest of the listeners don't do that, I think we're good.
I think everything you say is fascinating. Andy, we have so much stuff to get to. So on the docket today, we've got... a little bit of hype about Slow Horses, which is premiering on Apple on April 1st. We want to talk a little bit about Girl from Plainville. Watch the first episode of that. I know a couple of episodes are up. I wanted to chat with you a little bit about Winning Time, which I think had its best episode, the fourth episode recently.
I agree.
And the phenomenon, not even the phenomenon, but how we kind of, you know, how much of a chance people are giving shows right now, given how many of them are on and, you know, even two people who do a TV podcast, there's a couple of shows out there that I haven't even cracked that I want to get into. But what do you do when a show is hitting its stride mid-season, you know, and are there enough people around sticking around to watch? And of course, we want to get into Moon Knight, which premiered its first episode Wednesday morning. First, a couple of news bits. Andy, where did you want to start?
I just feel like there were just two kind of sad pieces of news in the ether. And I know I've been going over that email Jacoby sent us again, like in 2012. And he said, always start with jokes about turning off Bunsen flames and reading Pro Football Talk. And then second, sad news, lead with sad news.
Yeah, right.
You know, like get everyone bummed out. But for real, I felt like we just had to comment on the Bruce Willis story that broke yesterday, that Bruce Willis is retiring from acting, I guess, essentially effective immediately due to a deteriorating mental condition.
Aphasia.
From aphasia. So he struggles with memory and he struggles with expressing himself. And I no great takes other than I just so sad. Like Bruce Willis, a titan of our youth and adulthood in cinemas, right? Like, and as I was saying to you when we were texting, first of all, he was as good as anyone has ever been at doing that a very specific thing that he did. And that mixture of like machismo and sly kind of winking commentary is what action movies are now. Like he invented that with Die Hard, and which still I think is the movie I've seen more than any other movie. But I have you ever rewatchable that?
Yeah.
Have we done that?
I hosted that, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah.
I think it was a big week on the NFL waiver wire.
So you were
distracted. That's probably why I missed it. Yeah. I mean, it was probably like a lot going on. You know, I'm pretty passionate about edge rushers.
You were so, like the Jeremiah Trotter. You know,
sorry. Yeah, sorry, I missed it.
It's a couple years ago.
But also, you know, it was just kind of heavy to think about. Almost like feeling the totality of a person's career, you know, because you and I are old enough that we probably both learned about Bruce Willis by watching Moonlighting, even if we were staying up too late past our bedtimes to watch it and mm-hmm. being like, this guy's awesome. You know?
Yeah. You were commenting about how it's strange to be watching people kind of retire or step away from their professions. I feel this way with athletes all the time. I mean, mm-hmm. I very much like associate my professional adulthood with LeBron James in a lot of ways.
In terms of your commitment to excellence?
Yeah, and just also like bringing my friends up with me, like you, you know, like you kind of are like my St. Mary's basketball team.
Always.
Making sure you're always taken care of.
Always.
No, I mean, in all seriousness, it's a terribly sad story. One of the things that it made me think about, and it's people should check out this LA Times story because they get very much into the last few years of Willis's
right.
career, which has been marked with his very prolific participation in the VOD straight to streamer genre movie, like mostly action movie market. And, you know, Nick Cage also was doing this a lot for a mm-hmm. few years. And he was pretty candid about the fact that he was doing it to pay off debts and was like, you know, I had a tremendous amount of debt and I had to do all this, but I never phoned it in. And, you know, like some of those movies become kind of Mystery Science Theater, ironic, laugh-along classics. And I honestly haven't seen any of these Bruce Willis movies that have been coming out over the last couple of years. But it was kind of like sad to think about the circumstances that led him yeah. to be in those movies. And I, you know, can't really speculate as to why he was making five VOD movies a year or sometimes more. But yeah, like really one of like the biggest movie stars of my entire lifetime and definitely like a completely formative pop culture figure for both of us.
Well, it's hard to I mean, one shouldn't speculate, but at the same time, like the LA Times article suggests that it's a pretty huge payday for very relatively little work. And I think there's a positive read of that, which is just like if he had a sense or he and his family had a sense that the time was limited, he wanted to be doing what he loved to do and what he was recognized and celebrated for doing. There's a slightly less rosy version of it where it's a cash grab, but you know, those motivations are not for us to speculate on. It's just, he was so good, you know, and I got a little choked up thinking about like just the arc of those action movies, like obviously the Die Hard ones. And this will surprise no one that, you know, considering that our podcast begins with an audio clip from Bourne Legacy, universally recognized by no one but us as the best movie in that series. But Die Hard with a Vengeance still slaps.
Oh, like, yeah. One of the great New York movies.
I love that movie. But just thinking about him, like not just, you know, later career triumphs like Looper, but like, he's great in Moonrise Kingdom, you know,
oh, yeah.
Really smart, sly, sensitive actor. And you know, I just feel a little sad that we won't get to see him be the Clint Eastwood type,
yeah.
You know, because he had the demeanor and the charisma to certainly be that. So we're fans. We wish him and his family well. And then one other just really kind of just devastating bummer of the week was the passing of Taylor Hawkins, the drummer of Foo Fighters. Not much more to add to the general discourse. I mean, if Dave Grohl is like, you got to be my drummer, then clearly you're one of the greatest of your generation. And for people of our age, like just knowing through the screen what a charming and delightful person and performer he was, like his performance in the Big Me video where they recreated the Mentos commercial is still iconic. I just wanted to share one small anecdote because like 15 15, 16 years ago now, Spin sent me to LA. It was, obviously, I lived in New York, to do a Foo Fighters cover story. And I spent the day at their studio in the Valley, the one that is, I guess, the subject of that horror movie they made last year.
Yeah, yeah. I think it was this year, but yeah.
It was this year, right. This will also surprise no one. Couldn't be a nicer group of fellas. Just like at that point, I was like, man, these guys are old and really know how to be alive. And they were probably like 33 or something, which is hard to imagine, but couldn't have been nicer, more welcoming. Long chats, gave me, Grohl toured me around, like all the gold records, all the things that he had, you know, we had displayed on the wall. And Taylor Hawkins was, of a room full of friendly people, the warmest and friendliest of all. And really, really, really wanted to talk to me about Joe Walsh. Eagles guitarist Joe Walsh. Not really my forte. I think the limits of my Joe Walsh knowledge was that he famously gave a record the laziest title of all time, which is Got Any Gum.
It's like the best record title of all time.
But it really is.
Yeah.
But doesn't Ronnie Wood have a record called like, Guess I'll Make a Solo Album Then?
Or yeah, something like or that? It's like, that's me, folks, or something. Like, yeah, it's like...
But it's in that same vibe.
Yeah.
But anyway, we had this long talk and he was just proselytizing for like why Joe Walsh mattered so much. And did I know his early obscure stuff that was out of print? And I was like, no, but I'll check it out. And he's like, it's out of print. I don't know how you're going to check it out. Anyway, long day ends. I go out of the parking lot of the studio and I get in my rented Kia or whatever it was to drive back to the hotel. And all of a sudden there's a pounding on my window and it's Taylor Hawkins. And he's just standing there pounding on my window, like roll it down, roll it down, roll it down. And he hands me his own personal burned bootleg copy of Joe Walsh's Barnstorm.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, I just want you to have this.
Did you rock it? Did you let it rip?
The whole way back to West Hollywood, baby. Yeah.
And were you trying super hard to get into it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying Joe Walsh's Barnstorm is my favorite record. I'm just saying this dude was so kind and generous. He just ran and gave me a CD. I don't know. I just can't stop thinking about that moment. Obviously, people who really knew him and his family have deeper and more, you know, more important memories to share. It's just incredibly sad.
He seemed like an awesome, awesome guy. And like, the one thing that really like jumped out at me about him is, and what was the name of that Foo Fighters HBO show that we loved so much? Was that Sonic Highways from a couple years
ago?
Oh
yeah. Yeah. Of course.
And he makes, I think, some appearances in that, but man, like there are some people who do what they do because it's just what they've always done, and maybe they have a good gig doing it and it's a job. And he strikes me and has always struck me as somebody who did it because he loved it. Like he fucking loved rock, like a lot. And if people can bring themselves to do it, I recommend they check out, there's a YouTube video of his last performance with Foo Fighters in Chile. And he comes out from behind the drum kit and does Queen's Somebody to Love. He sings. And Grohl drums. And the way he introduces it is by being like, do you guys want to see Dave Grohl fucking drum? And it's like, yes, everybody wants that. But then Taylor does like a pretty good facsimile of Freddie Mercury. And they do the entire song with a huge long drum solo from Grohl. And Hawkins is just like beaming. It's like, he's just like, this is the best. I have like, honestly, the best drummer, one of the best drummers of all time. I play drums for him and he's just going hammer on this kit and they've got like backup singers doing the Somebody to Love. And it's just like this awesome, awesome celebration of this guy's life. And I recommend people check it out if they feel
like he'd love rock music.
He fucking loved it, man.
It was so nice that someone still did, you know, with that passion. It was cool.
Hard pivot. I wanted to ask you one newsy question before we got into like our show breakdowns. I don't know if you noticed that there was an announcement this week that House of the Dragon, the Game of Thrones prequel HBO is doing, is coming on August 28th. I believe it's August 21st, which is kind of cheeky, kind of little sharp elbows on the part of HBO, because Lord of the Rings is actually premiering September 1st, I believe. And I wanted to get your read on that. You know, like, everything's on all the time. Three episodes go up, whole seasons go up. You know, we're getting hit from every angle with new shows, with shows that are returning. We barely know what to do with ourselves in April. But I did find that there was, like, some old school, like, we like our hand going on here by HBO. And, you know, to the extent that you think that... media coverage of shows somehow does or doesn't make or break one. You know, I think that when a bunch of voices come out and say like, this is a masterpiece, I think it helps like a show, obviously. If there's like a huge fan reaction, it obviously helps. And there's a lot of conversation online. But I don't think that these two shows basically going up against one another is necessarily going to affect the viewership of one or the other. But I did find it really interesting that it was like, Not So Fast, Padawan, kind of.
Yeah.
You know, like,
well, two things. One, I found out about it instantly because, you know, after Slow Horses, I have an Olivia Cooke Google News alert set.
Okay, yeah.
And she's the star or one of the stars of House of the Dragon. So I, you know, obviously we're going to be talking about Slow Horses soon. Two, I think this is absolutely being interpreted correctly by you. I think that it speaks to a really healthy amount of confidence that HBO must be feeling for the quality of this show. Because to think about it in a macro sense, like they have as close to a sure thing as they're going to have in the next few years, in that they have not just new Game of Thrones content, but new Game of Thrones content with dragons, and it's the first one out the gate. Like even if they had gone ahead with the, whether it ended up being called The Long Night or whatever, but the aborted spinoff series show that they had, the first episode would have gotten a ton of eyeballs. I think that they made the assessment that it wasn't good enough to merit repeated viewings, so they didn't go with it. So they know they have something as close to a sure thing as they can have in this world. I bring that up because there's no shame in going after Lord of the Rings, because you'd have to imagine that if Lord of the Rings is good, there's still Game of Thrones interest. If Lord of the Rings isn't good, HBO's Mary Stuart Masterson and Some Kind of Wonderful. I've been here loving you the whole time, baby. Just pay attention. You know what I mean? Like they just have your reliable content.
I think
content.
That's exactly what they were thinking in the scheduling programming department, is they just had a picture of MSM from Some Kind of Wonderful.
Listen,
and they were like, that's us.
We know Casey Bloys a little bit. Like generationally that fits. I feel like he would cite that movie. Speaking of Casey, I also think that his control and, you know, and sort of unification of the HBO and HBO Max brands, part of that has come from a deep understanding of how to translate the HBO culture that we have always either rated correctly or overrated for the digital streaming age. And I think that that culture is supreme confidence. You know, like you guys can keep chasing noisy stuff and spending money and throwing stuff, but we're just going to be here making TV shows that people are going to want to watch. And I like it, by the way. Not just I like the show, we don't know if it's going to be good or not, but I like the cheekiness. I like the competitive spirit. And I feel like, you know, we sometimes do cover the streaming wars and things like sports teams, but that's probably got to make the HBO team, let alone, you know, the marketing team, let alone the people in development, feel pretty good. You know,
they're not running scared
from these big
did
boys.
Did other
and
shows
big
used
elves.
To clear out from Game of Thrones?
Yeah,
right. Like HBO used Game of Thrones to prop up or launch other shows or like give other shows a lot of exposure. But if I remember correctly, it would just be like, oh yeah, those are the 10 weeks that Thrones is on. So all the other big Sunday shows or big dramas or big prestige shows will probably like be before or after. So it's kind of wild to see them just be like, if you want to be the boss, you got to pay the cost a little bit to Elrond, you know?
Yes. Yes. Elrond Hubbard. Is that who you're speaking of?
No, the elf dude.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I do think it's pretty cool. And like, not to expand too far from this specific point, but like the little things that people in our seats like to overrate or at least focus or fixate on do matter, in the sense that like there's also been a, it's not even a scandal, but like Kim Masters, our favorite assassin at The Hollywood Reporter, had a story this week about Bob Chapek at Disney being potentially in hot water. He's in hot water specifically over the last few weeks because of Disney's bizarre two-step about the Florida Don't Say Gay bill and all that. But she used that as a way to talk about why his tenure is perceived as being shaky regardless. And a lot of it has to do with just communication style, right? Mm-hmm. Leadership style, the confidence that you're projecting in the way that you're dealing with people and dealing with situations that actually leak into the media. And like, that stuff matters. It does matter, you know, ultimately. Doesn't matter as much as whether the shows or the content, or, you know, the quality of that. Like, that's probably where we should begin and end most conversations. But I think it's a bullish indication of where HBO and HBO Max are, but I think it's also a reasonable one considering the year, year and a half that they're coming off of.
Should we stick with the mouse and talk about Moon Knight?
All right, let's do it, Ian, love. Get down to the gift shop, you. Great stuff.
We didn't talk about this before the show, so I don't know whether we are going to agree.
Yeah.
It's a testament to how much I like Oscar Isaac and Ethan Hawke that I am trying to like basically keep an open mind about this, right? Because I thought the first episode, they made a few episodes available to critics. I kind of just decided to watch the first one, partially just because I was watching other stuff, but also because like I didn't want to be like, oh, it gets really good in four or it gets really bad by three or whatever. But I don't think I can remember a choice this extreme in a major franchise blockbuster level TV show like the one that Oscar Isaac is doing, where like he basically is got a mood board. If you're talking about Mary Stuart Masterson being up on a cork board in the HBO programming department, I feel like Oscar Isaac's got like two pictures on his wall.
Okay.
Ace Ventura
and
The Mask. And he is going for it.
The Eric Stoltz movie Mask, Peter Bogdanovich directed,
the other Jim Carrey movie, like just the real somebody stop me vibes coming off him. Not necessarily always not in a bad way, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But it is definitely like you got to get your hands around this one a little bit. It takes a second.
We haven't talked about this. I loved it.
I knew you were gonna do this.
I loved it. I thought that it was, first of all, like, I don't think this is a controversial take to say that if it's not Ethan Hawke and Oscar Isaac, it's probably bad. Mm-hmm. Like, not bad, but it's serviceable, you know? I don't actually want to overrate their performances or just their charisma too much, because I thought that the construction of the episode and the approach to a very challenging, odd character were excellent. And I thought the direction by Mohamed Diab was really exemplary, like surprising, fluid, lively, had a lot of personality. But I just loved the tenor of it, basically because Oscar Isaac, one of our great actors, was like, yeah, I want to have fun with this. Like, what appeals to me about this isn't that I'm going to get to where, you know, get buff and like punch people, which at least through one episode, he doesn't do at all. He was like, I'm interested in the parts of the character.
He punches the ghost jaguar or whatever.
Yeah, but that's like CGI Moon Knight. Yeah. I don't even know if that's him. Like, right. He himself is an actor.
It's Pedro Pascal. I think he did that work.
I think he was, you know, has a lot of free time because he's rarely on the set of The Mandalorian. What appealed to him about this was the parts that made it a tricky proposition. The dissociative personality disorder, the potential to make really big choices. And then even within those choices, have it kind of work, because I think, you know, as we'll learn, these are all manifestations or different, you know, different personalities existing within one person who was not raised in Hackney or wherever. So the Dick Van Dyke-iness of his accent.
In Mary Poppins's purse. Yeah, right.
Exactly. It can be a little bit forgiven. But I thought that of all of, well, certainly WandaVision did this too, but this is the first Marvel series since WandaVision to be like, here we go, right from jump. Like, we're going to put you into something else and see how you feel about it. And that's, you know, maybe our bar has gotten really low, but like, that's kind of all I want out of these things, is I just want a different way in to what it will presumably be a relatively familiar journey.
So I think that there is some stuff tonally that I did like a lot. Like, you know, sometimes I wonder whether or not I actually need director bullshit to get through the night to help me find my way through the dark, because sometimes those kinds of, you know, those buoys help you a little bit. Like, oh, okay, now I see what you're going for. And there are shows like WandaVision, for instance, that are so formally kind of high concept that you immediately kind of recognize what you're dealing with, even if it's very like what could happen next. Are they going to the 70s or what's happening? I thought Moon Knight kind of had a little bit of Sam Raimi, a little bit of you know, Coen-y stuff, not a lot but a little bit, and I thought it was very noticeable
a little,
how
A little Jacob's Ladder, too. Remember that movie?
Oh, yeah.
I feel like that
Joel
was...
Joel Schumacher?
I think it was Schumacher. So I think there was a little Schumacher in there.
Yeah, a little shoe. Just a, mm-hmm. just a dab. It was really nice how unencumbered it was by other MCU stuff.
Oh, my God. They didn't talk about the blip.
Yeah, no blip, no superheroes, just Ethan Hawke wearing mandals and walking on glass and having doing cool tattoo tricks.
And holding sway with the power of an Egyptian god over a Swiss ski town?
Yeah. Yes.
Great. Classic. The Swiss, very trusting people. Very trusting.
Like the MCU's vision of Europe it's pretty tempestuous, right?
To be fair, Chris, like Sokovia was a major disruptor in the life of contemporary Europe and the European Union. You remember Tony Jude wrote that book like post-war, basically about how everything in Europe has to be seen through the lens of what... And I imagine he probably caked up writing a sequel after the Sokovia fiasco.
I'm sure he did very well for himself, yeah.
Right.
I think that when you were watching this at all, I heard Charles and Van and Jomie and Steve talking about this on Midnight Boys. Was there any part of you that was like, this could just be a movie? This would actually be a really cool movie?
Yes. And it probably could have or would have been a really cool movie. But I want to tread lightly here. I've only watched the first episode.
Yeah. That's the only one but, most people have watched. So
I know. But as you humble brag moments ago, you had access to others. Right. Some people did. So I just want to make it clear that I'm the voice of the common man here.
Yeah.
I work in the museum.
I just pretend to be like a common man.
Yeah.
By not watching my screeners.
And by looking at the football waiver wire instead of rewatching your screeners.
Oh my God, Bruce Arians retired.
The thing that I find so appealing is where you started this conversation, which was Oscar Isaac's having some fun with the opportunities being presented to him. And as... You know, I think he said this in interviews and he said this to us when we had him on our podcast a year ago. Ethan Hawke was like, I wasn't looking to be the villain in a Marvel TV show. Oscar called and was like, you want to come hang out in Europe and do this fun thing? And he was like, yes, I do. And that spirit is more TV to me, you know, like that they really are playing and having a go and having a laugh and seeing what it turns into. And it struck... This might really just come down to what a strong actor he is, but I really enjoyed the balance that it found between playing Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go and the kind of, you know, existential gods and goddesses museum horror that it was also playing with. Like it found a nice balance there. And then they also were like, yeah, let's hire F. Murray Abraham to be the voice in his head calling him an idiot while he resets his jaw. Like, yeah, let's try these things. Let's go. It's a delicate balance sometimes, but there was a feeling of adventure and fun in this that forgave whatever mistakes or whatever flaws may have been percolating.
Yeah, I guess
just for me.
I'm kind of like, just, you know what it is that when you watch something like this, and I've kind of felt this way a couple of times when Sam Raimi has made, whether it's a Spider-Man movie or like, you know, I'd be really curious to see like his Doctor Strange, because it's like, I think I associate a certain, not gore, but extremity with Sam Raimi. And he can find that in the PG-13 restrictions that are usually placed on you if you're making a superhero movie. But I kind of want, the fucked up extreme version of this show. And I just have to recalibrate that, like, this is on Disney Plus. It's not going to be scary. It's not going to be lit gothically or, you know, it's going to be Ethan Hawke wearing Yeezy season robes, like in the middle of the Alps. And you know, like that I just have to, like, every time an MCU show starts, I feel like I always am like, oh, I thought this was going to be like Last Boy Scout, but it's not.
The fun one.
You
know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's an inherent silliness to the character. I did this Moon Knight 101 thing before, but the quicker version of it is like the character exists because Marvel is like, what if we had Batman? And then in the years since, different aspects were added to the personality, that he's the embodiment of this Egyptian god, that he has multiple personalities, there's a voice in his head. There's been different ways to interpret the character. I think now pretty much disgraced and exiled comic book writer Warren Ellis did a big reimagining reboot of him a few years ago that had great design. I should shout out the artist. I don't have him off the top of my head, but like took that, the cowl suit that we're seeing, and reimagine it as just like a guy with a hood over his, with a basically like a cloth over his face, wearing an immaculate white suit, you mm-hmm. know, and playing into the extremity, to use your word, of multiple personalities in a, you know, Egyptian dealer of night violence. So I think some of that is in here, and it's tough to find. In comics, it's easier to be both silly and commenting on the silly and also dark, and I think that they're finding their way through that. But I think it's baked in, and I just really loved the fact that generally when an actor puts on a cowl or agrees to do this sort of part, they amplify in one specific direction, whether that's Christian Bale's voice that he did to become Batman. I haven't seen The Batman yet. I think people listening have assumed that because I just haven't quite had a 3.5-hour hole in my schedule recently to do it. I would like to see it. I would love to talk about it with you when I do.
You know, it's coming. Everything... You're going to have it on HBO Max before you know it.
Just as they all intended. But like, from what I understand, Pattinson did a similar thing, right? Like you steer your abilities into what you perceive to be the correct skid for the character. Like that's what's expected of it. So I do my version of it. And yeah. What I loved about this was Oscar Isaac can do that. And at the end, when he's more Mark Spector, shout out one of Marvel's prominent Jewish superheroes, looking into the mirror, he's doing the gravelly voice. Like
he does,
when
they have that, and spoilers for, I guess we've also talked a little bit about this, but
yeah.
In the final scene of the first episode, yeah. And it's the mirror battle, you know, the other Oscar Isaac, the born legacy Oscar Isaac is in that mirror. Yeah. And you're like,
he can do that, but this is as easy a switch to flip for him as the other. And I think that makes it a more elastic and surprising and just pleasant, fun performance that like he got to play the two ends of it.
I'm happy that you're happy. It's not that I don't have a take on the show yet. It's just that I thought it was going to be a little bit different. I also think a lot of this first episode is in the trailer too. So I was like, saw this part.
But I also think that so far, you know, and at this point, so much time has passed and so much discourse has been written or expressed. Like I think WandaVision is probably underrated. Like I was so down on what it turned into that I'm definitely like undervaluing how strong and surprising and creative the beginning was. So I want to be mindful of that. But at the same time, this show, Jeremy Slater is the credited creator and writer, and with what Michael Waldron did with Loki, like these are the two that, to my mind, just hit the ground running, being like, "We're going to do this."
Yeah,
you know, I know what I'm going to. I have a sense of what world this is and how I'm going to take you into it. And you know, for as much as we want to give those creators credit, I also think that the people in similar roles on like Hawkeye and Winter Soldier, that's much dicier terrain because those are very, very, very connected, continuity-heavy characters with a lot of baggage from the mm-hmm. movies that they had to be worked out at the same time. So those were not, I just want to always be mindful when I say that because it's not like all of these jobs are equal in terms of the potential for meddling or the potential for expectations and what people are checking for. These are minefields. And so far through one episode, I just thought it was light. Yeah, which I didn't expect.
This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, file a claim right on the State Farm mobile app, and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Free samples, free shipping, and our 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step and into your home too. Shop Blinds.com now and save up to 45%. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're talking about knowing what you are. You're talking about hitting the ground running.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Slow Horses, which premieres tomorrow or on the 1st. New Apple show. We've talked about it on this podcast before. It's a 6-episode spy thriller adapted from the first book in the Slough House series by Mick Herron. It's about basically loser spies who have been cast out of like the circles of power in the MI5 and are working in a satellite office above a Chinese restaurant, you know, in a rainy, well, it's always raining in London, but like it seems to rain especially a lot in this neighborhood. And it's a group of spies who are being overseen by a guy named Jackson Lamb, who's played amazingly by Gary Oldman, who now has two iconic spy performances under his belt with this and George Smiley and Tinker Tailor. And if you want to talk about a show that hits the ground running, and we won't spoil it for people because, you know, because we got to see episodes beforehand, but it comes out tomorrow. Maybe my favorite first scene in a show in the last like 5 years, in terms of you get a sense of the visual style, you get a sense of the sensibility and the writing, the humor, and the sort of the boundaries of the way in which the show, where the show is going to be working. Like, you know, mm-hmm. what is and isn't out of bounds for this show. And inside of those boundaries, inside of that sandbox, like what they get away with and what they play with and the charm, the just sheer charm of this cast and this show. It is like executive produced by Graham Yost. And the easiest way I can describe it is Justified made, if Justified was an English spy show.
Yeah. I mean, I think people who listen to us regularly know that we were always going to be the softest targets for a spy show, especially a spy show set in contemporary London. And then you get Gary Oldman involved. Like, it, the more information that came out about the show, the more clear it was that we were going to love it. But even so, I was really impressed with the first episode. It is a masterclass in bringing you into a world and making you comfortable there. And, to your point exactly, like just communicating the facts, the stakes, and just the sort of the general contours of the playground that we're going to be in. You know, it's funny, but it's a little bit serious too. The stakes are where they are, you know, and you kind of just, you just get it. And there's this moment in it that I was so impressed by when, and as Chris alluded, like we're following specifically a character named River Cartwright, who in the beginning is a promising agent MI5 and then finds himself in the doghouse or in the Slough House,
yeah.
with the rest of the losers who are a motley and fun bunch to be with, including Olivia Cooke, who I think is really good as Sid, maybe the least losery of the losers, at least in the early going. But there's a scene where he has to return back to Regent's Park where the posh, classy MI5 office is. And it's also just some great workplace comedy that he has to like get a minder and take a picture with the,
get a, you know, temporary pass to get into the building and stuff.
Get a lanyard to go in. And he has an interaction with his rival, who's just a great character played by a great British character actor, Freddie Fox, who, as we noted when he was in The Pursuit of Love last summer, is not the rapper also known as Bumpy Knuckles. But again, I do think that we should create some sort of transatlantic trade where we could potentially swap them in any given moment in time.
I don't think that the character of River would have gotten away with what he gets away with that guy if it was actually Freddie Fox.
I wish that in the world there was a button we could just hit every so often and they would swap.
Yeah.
In any moment in their lives. But anyway, in that scene, and this is not a spoiler, it's just scene craft. It's just good writing. And the series was adapted by a guy named Will Smith, who is, if I don't think he was Googleable before. I think this week has particularly been a tough beat for him. But in the scene.
Can you imagine if we had him on the pod today? And yes, Kyle was just like, today on the pod, Will Smith. That was the headline.
We screwed up.
Yeah.
Kaya's crying SEO tears.
It's just like
right
this
now.
British guy from the Iannucci tree. And it's like, yeah, like, what you guys are expecting? Yeah.
So the character Freddie Fox plays is nicknamed Spider Web. And he basically takes a moment where he's just like, do you know why it's called Slough House, even though Slough is not London? And the River's just like, yes, I do know. And then the guy explains it. And he explains it for the audience. Yeah. Because a narrator could explain it. But he explains it, and we're like, oh, now we know, especially an international audience that doesn't understand the significance of saying Slough when it's not London. And then River gets to put, you know, a little cap on the whole thing, being like, it's not actually a joke if you have to explain it. That's just a tiny bit of script writing.
Yes.
You know, but it's elegant. It's elegant. It's like not dumbing down for us, the audience learning about this world, but it's also welcoming us in a way that I think puts everyone at ease. And then you add to it just that everything that I think Apple in the best case scenario can do for a project, which is bring
out London,
A plus people, and literally rent out London and then get out of the way, because the vibes here are immaculate. Like the rain, the takeaway, the streets, the buses, just the feel for a place. Even the building of Slough House itself, you know, the creaking staircase, the up and down, the understanding the geography of where the characters are, so that when Gary Oldman's minder wants someone to come to him, he just stamps on the floor. You know,
yeah, he hits the bottom of the floor with a broom. Yeah.
It's completely realized and lived in a way where, and I think anyone watching this, even if you're not as gaga for this stuff as we are, like, turn it on. You'll be like, oh, we're in good hands. We're going to watch this.
No, I mean, I think the other point you were going to make was just that, or the point you just made is right, which is if you get Kristin Scott Thomas to play the director of operations for MI5 the way they do, and she's essentially, I think, I don't know how many scenes she's in, but it's like not a huge part. It's just a hugely important part.
Yes, right.
But like Kristin Scott Thomas can communicate so much like about that character because she's just so fucking good. So she can roll her eyes, or she can arch an eyebrow, or she can put her hands in her pockets. And like the way that they kind of like they dress the characters tells you so much about them. Like
the ties.
Gary Oldman character is just an absolute slob with holes in his socks. Kristin Scott Thomas looks like the Anna Wintour of MI5. And just like the way that they kind of construct all these people. I hope people who are hearing us give it a chance, because it's pretty awesome.
We shouldn't also say, like, again, it's just an embarrassment of riches, because River's career is saved because he's the grandson of a famous MI5 operative. And River goes to see his grandfather and like make dinner for him, and they sip whiskey by a fire. And look, if you're making a British spy show, I want immaculate people talking shit about fascism in front of a roaring fire. Like that's part of what you expect when you buy the ticket. And it wouldn't matter who was sitting there, honestly, as long as they were wearing a nice suit. But it's Jonathan Pryce. And Jonathan Pryce, one of the great English actors, who generally gets hired to do more extravagant Jonathan Pryce things like he did on Game of Thrones. But guess what all these British master thespians can also do? They can sit in chairs and just hold your fucking attention, you know?
Dude, you know what's also great about that scene? Awesome. And I don't want to like be like, here's another great part of this first episode that people haven't gotten a chance to see it. But that scene you're talking about, which is just basically another exposition scene where you find out why was he excommunicated from the service, why was River sent out and all this stuff. There's just like a brief second where they have like a little argument about like whether the lemons are fresh enough to make a chicken, like this chicken dish that they're
Should you
do.
Store them in the refrigerator, or should you store them on the counter?
Don't need to have that in there, but it's perfect. It's like, make these people feel like a little bit alive by having them have a digressive conversation.
And that's throughout. It's a great call by you to mention that, because I think that often when we are more critical of shows, it's because the plot machine has taken up all the space and there isn't room for just a single line like that. And really, it's my, perhaps tiresome to some people, Spice Market diatribe. Like, just show me something real. Give me a sense of something lived in, almost as a white balance for all the other bright stuff that you're showing. Now I understand it. These are real people, but crazy stuff's happening. But they still argue over how best to store citrus in a, what I imagine to be a very humid circumstance in London, judging by the precipitation.
You'll know soon enough.
It's true. I'm going to Slough House.
Yeah. What do you want to do next? Because I think, you know, a good example of a show that maybe has struggled a bit as it's gone on with how to communicate a personality while also dragging a bunch of exposition behind it is Winning Time. We are both fans of this show. I think strangely the way, like the vibe I'm getting is that we might be outliers in how much we like this show. I think part of that is because this is a show that kind of maybe wasn't made for anyone or wasn't made for everyone. And now they're not sure who is supposed to watch it. There is this weird tension with this show where I think it's maybe not historically accurate enough for basketball historians. It's a little too explainery for people who are like, yep, I know how a fast break works, you know, but then it's a little dense for casuals, you know? And so it's kind of trying to find its footing here all the while, pretty much every episode and a half, introducing another major character and another major character and another major character to the extent now we're on episode 4, which is my favorite of the season so far, where the Lakers go to Palm Springs for their training camp and their first training camp under their new coach, Jack McKinney, which played by one of the patron saints of the watch, Tracy Letts. Adrian Brody is like a bit player in this episode. Like if it wasn't Adrian Brody and if he wasn't playing Pat Riley, you'd be like, that's just the guy who has the camera, like walking back and forth. And there's some stuff that happens in this episode that I think, like, if you don't like this, I don't know what to tell you. You know, like the ecstasy coming off the screen during the first scrimmage that Jack McKinney runs, and then the subsequent scrimmages where they start to figure out how to play Showtime basketball, is like, if there's better scenes this year, we'll be in luck, you know, because it's so exciting and viscerally like thrilling to watch them kind of figure this out. But I was kind of wondering where you were at with this show, because I think it's kind of come in for a little bit of an eye roll collectively from people.
To quote a tweet that has been sent to us by countless egg avatars over the years, stick to sports. This was the first episode really to be about basketball. I mean, obviously the show is about more than basketball, and it should be, but it was very impressive to me the degree to which they got the basketball right. Not saying that like these actors were setting perfect pick and rolls or whatever. I just mean it's really hard to film sports and make it seem
incredibly hard. Yeah.
As we've talked about, you know, I
know.
Unfortunately, the great film Doctor Strange, you know, that was really its only downside. And, you know, and we almost broke up with Sam Esmail over the basketball in season 2 of Mr. Robot. To capture not just the technical what's happening on the court, but like, as you say, the ecstasy of when it's flowing and the excitement and just the thrill that watching bodies in motion bring people who watch the sports, like to do that with the added piece of the character work and the emotion, I was really impressed by all of it. But I also was really impressed by the episode overall, because this to me felt like a show fully finding its footing and finding itself. Last week, we were talking about how it started to seem like the Adam McKay aesthetic formal innovations
falling away a little bit.
Were falling away. Like they were just like every few shots will just cut to a different grain on the, you know, on the footage. This week brought it roaring back
in
a way that felt really natural and fun, whether it was Tracy Letts, floating in the sort of like Zen utopia nirvana of basketball bliss, or the way the camera was cutting, the way, you know, the word loser goes on the screen every time Adrian Brody is there. It felt of a piece with the story that it wanted to tell. It was vibrant. It was fun. It was surprising. It was very, as it always has been, entertaining. And I'm curious about this idea that we're outliers by enjoying it. I do think that we're all a little like Twitter broken and discourse broken, because this show doesn't fit into the kind of, I mean, to pull from the episode, the kind of like you're A team, I'm B team way that we tend to talk about things now. Like this is either the best thing ever or it's absolutely like, you know, evilly intentioned bullshit. I think that the show is devilishly entertaining, which is really all it needed to be. But I'm pretty thrilled and a little bit inspired by the electricity of the project as it rolls along. Because every week we talk about how we're awash in ripped from the headlines types of stories, and we're about to talk about another one. And they all seem to follow a similar aesthetic script. like a certain, you know, slavish devotion to the historical record or to the way things might have looked or felt. And this show just doesn't care about that. And now I understand that people are sore about, like, that might not actually be how Jerry West behaved or whatever. And I don't want to speak to the discomfort one might feel of having one's life or legacy treated for LOLs in a TV show. I hope that never happens. And we should, you know, we should back channel with Casey, because I know that HBO still technically controls the rights to our friendship because of some kind of dodgy paperwork we signed around Talk the Thrones. But all that aside, speaking purely like the product on the screen, it's really exciting to watch the show. It is so fun to have great actor after great actor show up and just do their damnedest to, like, elevate this thing, you know, see it all sing on the court. It's a good metaphor for what the series as a whole did with this episode.
Damian Marcano directed this episode at one point. I think I read an article about, like, his, like, sort of the behind the scenes of how he shot the basketball stuff. He had cameramen on rollerblades. You know, I mean, that's what this show is that kind of, like, let's just throw it all on the wall and see what sticks. Some stuff's going to drop off, you know, and there are points where it seems so fractured and so consumed with, like, having every single element get its screen time, you know? So it's like, it's not just Kareem and Magic driving out to the desert and Norm Nixon driving out to the desert. It's also Michael Cooper driving out to the desert, and they all got to be driving out to the desert, and Julianne Nicholson's got to be driving Jack McKinney, and here's Jerry Buss in his car. And it's like, I got it. We're all driving, but, like, it really wants it all. It's a maximalist show. And then there are points in the show, like during those scrimmages, where they're cutting to animation, they're cutting to voiceover from multiple different characters, they're cutting to illustrations on top of footage, they're cutting to the footage that Pat Riley supposedly, you know, not the actual footage, but VHS tape that Pat Riley was in charge of shooting to make basically a demo tape that Jerry West wants to see, that's green tinted because he can't get the color tint right in the camera. It's like, if you can go along with the formalism of it and, like, the innovation in that side, I think that you can get over some of the occasionally very expository scenes of just, like, this is who I am and this is what I want. And, like, a lot of what is happening on this show is a fait accompli. Like, we know that they, Laker girls, are coming. So the five conversations that Claire Rothman and Jeannie Buss have about, well, we got to do something that just brings sexiness to the, what could that be? Yeah. What could we do? And then it's like, yes, finally we get to the last scene and it's the Laker girls. But, you know, I can see why people would have trouble with it, but I find it exciting enough to watch that it doesn't bother me.
I think that the maximalism of it suits the subject matter. It suits the ambition of the network that made it. And I also think it's worth suggesting that it doesn't get everything right. Like, it wants to be really good at everything on the court. And, for example, like, whatever psychological storytelling it was interested in exploring and unpacking with Jeannie Buss, like seeing as a child, seeing her father working the baseline, let's say, with a young lady who's definitely not her mother, and then giving her father what he wants with the Laker girls, like, that's real heavy psychological lifting.
Yeah.
Does the show spend enough time in the gym to be able to do that deadlift? I'm not entirely sure that it did, but I think that Hadley Robinson, who plays Jeannie Buss, is an unsung hero of the show. I think she's delivering a great, interesting performance. I think that similarly, like, I can't say enough about Quincy Isaiah's performance as Magic, or in this episode, we finally got more of Solomon Hughes as Kareem. Like, that is almost impossible what those guys are doing, and they're doing it. Like, I believe that they are who they say they are, even they're two of the most famous people of our lifetimes, right? And I think that's really remarkable.
Let's hit Plainville before we go.
Yeah, so this is, you know, not as you were saying, Chris, like, it's interesting. Winning Time, we're talking about maybe peaking in episode 4. I've heard people say similar things about The Dropout, a show that I have fallen behind on.
Yeah, the fourth episode of The Dropout is quite something, yeah.
So it feels a little bit, hopefully not disrespectful, but certainly not complete to be talking about Girl from Plainville on Hulu after just one episode. But I did want to shout it out, not only because it was co-executive produced, co-show run by friend of the pod, Liz Hanna, but I was really impressed by it. And the reason I was impressed by it was precisely in response to some of the criticisms that I've been lobbing at the Rip from the Headlines docu-shows that we've been watching. The thing that I keep coming back to, like, to use the first episode of The Dropout as a probably unfair punching bag, which is that Amanda Seyfried's performance is so thrilling and weird, and it feels crammed into a box that doesn't quite fit it or suit it, that because of the historical record being what it is, the ceiling of these shows artistically is dropped, is lower, because they can't take chances. And on paper, a show about the infamous involuntary manslaughter via text case in Massachusetts that a lot of people in the country are aware of, that's what the show is based on, where a young man took his life, and then his ex or his girlfriend was put on trial for the text messages that she had sent him, potentially encouraging him to do it. I can't think of a topic that I am just off the jump less interested in spending time with on television. It seems dark. It's, you know, in the public record. But watching this first episode, which was directed by indie great Lisa Cholodenko and shot by Frederick Elmas, who is one of the great cinematographers of our time.
Yeah.
And
David Lynch's preferred cinematographer, right?
And larded with great, great actors like Elle Fanning at the peak of her powers. I mean, you and I mean, what about Buono? I mean, she's always top tier.
Chloe Sevigny, yeah.
Chloe Sevigny really bringing it.
And Butts, man, you don't sleep on Norbert Leo Butts. First of all, star of the stage, but you know, always loved that dude in Bloodline.
The show does something that I just think is noteworthy, which is this is material that is both upsetting and potentially salacious. And I thought the first episode had a really, really tight artistic sense of itself and feeling of control that I was very impressed by. It's hard to say that a show about the subject matter that also features Elle Fanning giving an extra performance, I think probably an appropriate one, but still an extra one. It's hard to say that something like this is understated, but that was my takeaway from the episode in a way that really impressed me because it felt like a project that had a reason for being and something to say other than potentially the fact that they got a good deal on the life rights or an article option, you know, at some point recently and thus got a straight to series order, which is, again, I'm using these other series as straw men. That's not why these shows exist necessarily, but it's just reflective of the kind of sentiment that I've been building about the industry and where it's been over the last 6 months. And it was nice to have this as an antidote so far.
It kind of reminded me of this... I remember this BBC show, or maybe it was a Channel 4 show from a few years ago called Southcliffe, which was about a mass shooting in a town. Sean Durkin, who's a really great filmmaker, made it. And I think Sean Harris, who people probably know from the Mission Impossible movies, plays the shooter. And it's essentially like this town kind of trying to come to grips with this seemingly random act of horrific violence. And it's basically like, remember when we were talking about like the Bad News Relay a couple of years ago where it was like,
oh yeah, with Broadchurch
and like just that moment where, you know, this absolute tragedy gets related to a bunch of people and like people, you know, fall to their knees. Yes. And it's kind of like this real like gut wrenching moment. And the way that almost everything so far in Plainville has been handled really reminds me more of like this. And I think appropriately so, like this almost British sensibility of being like just the facts. And like, even when Chloe Sevigny is like, and she's in the bathroom texting and finds out about, and her, I think it's her husband who's like, are you with the girls
her
now?
Ex, or something. Yeah.
Her ex. Like they don't play that for maximum devastation. It's really like another, it's just another event that they're documenting. And I think that there's a real, like obviously artistry to what like the direction and the cinematography is doing, the writing is top notch, but it's like, we are not going to tell you how horrible this is. It's horrible, you know, like, and yeah. I think that the character who I was most kind of like gravitating towards was the detective.
Kelly O'Coyne.
Yeah. Who's like going through the step-by-step process of being like, this, something doesn't seem right, you know, and then kind of for people who have watched, they know, but like for people who don't know, it's basically this case where a teenager named Conrad Roy took his own life. And it seems like he was being egged on by this girlfriend that he had named Michelle Carter, who's played by Elle Fanning. But like a lot of people in both of their lives didn't really seem to understand or know about their relationship. And anyway, like the way in which they depict this is very, very, very matter of fact. And I think that that's the appropriate tone to strike. That being said, you know, when you're watching it, you're like, this is tough sledding. I mean, like, this isn't like quote unquote entertaining TV, right?
Yeah, it's not entertaining TV, but there is a there's a spark here.
Well, it's precision,
you know? Not just precision, but like it's a strange case. And I think again, the perspective matters, like our relationship to the different parties investigating, and the detective being like, "Huh?" or like not really understanding, wondering if this is just how teenagers are. Like, I think that it has enough space from it in a way that is respectful and appropriate. We are not embedded in any one faction of this case. We are considering the case, which I think serves it well because it allows for, as you said, a very artful rendition of the bad news montage. I was kind of on the edge of my seat, and maybe in a way on the edge of falling off of the show entirely, sure, wondering how that would be handled. But it's handled quickly, it's matter-of-factly, and I don't think it's a spoiler to give this line away, but the aforementioned Norbert Leo Butz, who plays the deceased father, when he's on the phone, he doesn't lose it. He doesn't do the fall to his knees. He says, well, there's police tape all around our son's car. Why? Yeah. You know, and it's matter of fact, but it's everything is in that line. And that shows restraint, which I think earns the show the ability to have Elle Fanning's character, Michelle, after getting the news herself, appear totally destroyed. Like she's thrown up on herself. There's tears everywhere. And she says what's happened. She says Conrad's dead, and her family, Cara Buono plays her mom, just says, who's Conrad?
Right.
So you earn both moments, you know, and it's a delicate dance, but it's one that I think is, at least through one episode, they've pulled off. And I think that's a challenge.
Yeah,
I think
for
that's
sure.
Very hard to do.
So I recommend it. I'll be sticking with that one. I hope people watch Slow Horses. I guess next week
we should talk, because listen, I don't want anyone to get the wrong idea. This is not a contractual holdout like it was in all of 2019 when I pretended to make a TV show, but needed to get secure the bag. Like that's right. Really what that was about. Your boy's going on vacation. Chris has promised to fill my seat with only B-listers because I get threatened and spooked easily because as everyone knows, because people are always like, oh, you guys have... People are always like, you guys have such good chemistry and rapport. And what maybe some of them don't realize is that, Chris, you can do that with anybody.
Like, well, my plan is to, on Monday, have one of two Will Smiths on, and we'll see which one comes on, you know?
I think that's very exciting. And I don't think you should put any time pressure on either. You know what I mean? Like, see which one shows up.
No, Kai and I will just record for like 24 hours and we'll see who calls first.
It's good of you to tell Kai now. She loves that kind of management.
I think Kai's on vacation too, so she'll be fine.
It's a company retreat. Did we not get the email? So I will be out for the next 2 weeks unless there's, you know, some breaking news, and I'll just record a voice memo.
Well, I would like it if you sent me a Moon Knight dispatch from a museum gift shop.
Okay. Yeah. No, that's great. I mean, I wouldn't want to interrupt your waiver wire time, because without me here, I think you'll finally, you know, you'll really be able to put next season's fantasy squad together in a way that's consistent with your values of team building. But I'll do what I can. I'll do what I can.
It's really,
and obviously, I'll miss all you guys.
Really, I emphasize speed.
Do you, above all else?
Yeah, I think character guys too. You know,
what about? You know, Bill's been saying this a lot recently. At the end of the day, what about just winning mentality? What about winning players?
Yeah, no, that is definitely something I ask all my guys. Do you love this game? You know?
That's why it's going to be hard to fill this chair for 2 weeks, you know, because
who's
going to
humor me
enough
about this stuff? That's right. I know a lot of people who just do TV podcasts. I don't know a lot of people who love TV. Not like you.
That's right. Let me just look at the last hour plus. We just watched more TV this week than I did all of the aforementioned 2019. So you're welcome, America.
We were produced, as we always are, by Kaya McMullen. This is Andy's final show on the watch for 2 weeks. And wish him well on his vacation.
I really thought you were going in a different direction with that, but
and
I guess we'll find out.
We'll be back on Monday. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you guys soon.
A wonderful, wonderful fortnight, Baranskis.